Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Helgi Walker for petitioners, CTIA and Sprint Nextel. With the Court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
You know how it is in this Court. We may or may not let you.
Yes, sir. In the orders on review, the FCC adopted a rule requiring wireless carriers to provide 8 hours of emergency backup power at all cell sites nationwide. This rule suffers from 3 fatal legal flaws. First, the agency was without statutory authority to adopt this rule in the first place. Second, in the course of promulgating the rule, the agency violated the notice and comment provisions of the EAPA. Third and finally, the rule is arbitrary and capricious in several respects, undercutting its basic purpose by resulting in the provision of less 911 service rather than more. With regard to statutory authority, the crucial threshold consideration in this case, we respectfully submit that the agency has simply stretched the doctrine of ancillary authority past its breaking point. Ancillary authority only exists where the rule at issue is first within the Commission's general jurisdiction and second, reasonably ancillary to the effective performance of a specific statutory duty of the agencies. Section 2A grants the Commission jurisdiction over interstate communications by radio. According to the agency, the rule is within this jurisdictional test because it pertains to the provisioning of wireless service, but this standard is unacceptably broad. Importantly, and as animated this Court's holding in American Library Association, the Commission's theory has no logical stopping point and thus would confer virtually limitless jurisdiction on the agency. It would allow, for instance, the regulation of internal cell phone batteries, fuel stockpiles, fuel reserves, security at cell sites, and even commercial power itself, which, of course, is arguably more important to the provision of wireless service than emergency backup power, which may never be necessary at all. These matters are, of course, all clearly outside the Commission's jurisdiction, and I think even the Commission would admit that. But nonetheless, there's no rational basis. They've offered no principled basis for stopping their jurisdiction short of these absurd results. So the Commission has failed the first prong of the ancillary authority test, but it also fails the second prong. The second prong requires that the rule be ancillary, and reasonably so, to some specific duty that the Congress has charged the agency with executing and enforcing. Here the agency has relied on one provision of the Communications Act, and that is Section 1. Section 1, however, is not a grant of substantive regulatory power. Section 1 is a general purpose provision, and a brief review of its text makes this clear.
It's a preamble. Section 1 is not a jurisdictional section. All it says is that here's the reason we're establishing the FCC.
It's exactly right, and that is what I was about to explain. If one reads it,
there's a whole line of cases that are not cited in your brief talking about the effect of preambles of this sort in interpreting legislation, and that line of cases indicates that it's quite favorable to your position, although you haven't cited it.
Well, we did explain that in NARUC, this Court explained that Section 1 is a general purpose provision. It does set forth some worthy aims towards which the Commission should strive in the execution and enforcement of the provisions of the Act that Congress has charged it with taking care of, but it has never been read as a general grant of authority. Cases in the Eighth and the Ninth Circuit are in accord.
Well, those cases were dealing with state preemption, and the Second Circuit, as well as this Court, in a case you say should be read in terms of Title II, and yet that is not what the Court said in Computer and Communications Association. And isn't this panel bound by that decision, which says that indeed Title I authority can support ancillary jurisdiction where there is a nexus to the general purposes for which the Commission was established, consistent with the Supreme Court's decision in Southwest Cable about the effective ability of a Commission to effectively carry out its responsibilities?
Well, CCIA may not have used the word Section 205 as the provision to which the Commission's rule was found reasonably ancillary.
Well, but specifically, excuse me, go ahead.
But they did find, Your Honor, that the commission's rule was ancillary to the purpose of making sure that interstate transmission rates were reasonable. That's just paraphrasing Section 205.
Southwest Cable didn't deal with Section 1.
Southwest Cable, the Supreme Court's decision, I was referring to CCIA, Southwest Cable did teach that while a rule doesn't have to have an explicit statutory basis, it must, under the ancillary authority doctrine, at least relate back in some plausible way to a provision of the Act.
Well, there's been a lot made of that one line and use the word ancillary in Southwest Cable. I tend to think too much has been made of it, but in any event, the Supreme Court's decision there was not an interpretation dealing with Section 1 of the Act. It was an interpretation dealing with Section 2 of the Act.
That's right. The commission,
and the commission here said directly that this backup rule rests on Section 1. So I don't know that Southwest Cable really adds anything to the commission's position.
It doesn't. Southwestern Cable shows that the agency has been given some limited ancillary authority, but only where they can show that the rule they've adopted without an explicit statutory basis is reasonably effective to the performance of some duty that Congress has given it. Section 1 can't be ancillary to itself. A rule can't be ancillary to the execution of the general purpose of the agency. The doctrine is quite permissive already, and in the absence of the Commission being able to point to some duty that Congress actually charged it with executing and enforcing under the ensuing provisions of the Act, we think they have failed under prong two.
Well, what do you do with our precedent?
Well, the precedent can be harmonized, Your Honor. If one reads it carefully, it can be put into one of two buckets. There is a line of cases that shows that that courts have allowed the agency to regulate, for instance, cable, over which it had no direct power, because that regulation was thought necessary to the performance of the commission's Title III duties over broadcasters. So in Southwestern Cable, the Supreme Court permitted the exercise of ancillary jurisdiction because the agency said, we have to do this in order to protect broadcasters, and we clearly have authority under broadcasters, over broadcasters, under Title III. Mm-hmm. A second class of cases, including this court's decision in CCIA, New England Telephone, Rural Telco, and the Second Circuit's decision in GTE, all fall into the Title II bucket.
CCIA, the court said the agency was not regulating under Title II.
They weren't,
but specifically, and the court said, but it has authority to do it under.
And the reason it had authority to do it was because regulation of CPE was necessary because the inclusion of CPE in tariffs had, and I quote, a direct effect on interstate transmission rates. That paraphrases the Commission's basic duty under Title II to ensure just and reasonable rates for common carriers. So all of those cases, perhaps they don't cite Section 205, but they speak in terms of the justification being premised on the Commission's duty to ensure just and reasonable rates for interstate transmissions.
And here the Commission argues this is necessary in order to establish transmissions so that you can decide whether or not just and reasonable rates.
They have never premised this on the need to ensure just and reasonable rates. That's nowhere.
No. But I'm just taking your argument. All right. The Commission says we can't carry out any of our responsibilities unless we have some source to be assured that we're going to be able to have transmission of service.
Well, that would be an interesting case, Your Honor, but it's not this case.
Backup power.
Well, there are lots of things that are necessary inputs to the provision of wireless service, but the Commission, despite its broad authority in many areas, simply hasn't been charged with overseeing all of them. Electric power itself, local commercial power itself, is absolutely critical to the provision of wireless service.
So the Commission has no authority until there is actual service being provided.
Well,
that's your position?
No, our position is that American Library interpreted Section 2A, the jurisdictional provision, to say the core of jurisdiction of the agency is over the transmission itself. Once you go beyond the transmission itself, the agency has some limited additional jurisdiction over apparatus,
That case was talking about the Commission trying to order manufacturers of television sets to do something.
That's true.
Here, the commission's speaking to the regulated parties.
That is true, but it has reached so far beyond the transmission itself to try to get to backup power that it's just outside the jurisdictional prong. And it's outside the second prong as well, Your Honor. The commission's position on the second prong of the act can be boiled down to this proposition. The agency can do whatever it wants if it deems it to further the interest of public safety, which it hooks back to Section 151, which, as Judge Randolph pointed out, is just a preamble. So long as Congress has not specifically prohibited that action. And that proposition, respectfully, is out of the bounds of this Court's precedent. Three times in the last 6 years,
yeah,
this Court—
I read that statement in their brief. I don't really think they're making that argument. Due respect, I mean, they've been told repeatedly that that argument isn't going anywhere.
Indeed, they have been told repeatedly, and yet that is the basis of their position under the second prong of the ancillary authority test.
No, I read their position a little differently, that if they're to be given these responsibilities in order to effectively carry them out, here's what they have to be able to do. And they link it back under to their Section 1, you know, preamble purposes.
Well, they believe they have a duty to effectuate, they believe they have a mandate to further public safety under Section 1, but they haven't pointed to anything else. And they do say in their briefs that Congress hasn't prohibited them from doing this, and therefore they can. And I just think that's out of the bounds of this Court's precedent. And, Your Honor, it makes the rest of the Communications Act largely unnecessary. If Section 1 was a freestanding vehicle for regulation, the Commission could derive both its jurisdiction and its statutory authority from that provision. There was no need for Congress to have gone on and added the ensuing provisions of this Act that it thought it was charging the agency with executing and enforcing, as it says in the concluding sentence of Section 151. The agency would have needed nothing but Section 1 itself, and the rest of the Communications Act was largely superfluous.
Well, it would have had to have jurisdiction over common carriers and interstate. I mean, there are all kinds of provisions that would have been necessary.
Not on the FCC's reading, with respect, Your Honor. They believe they can find substantive regulatory power in Section 1 itself, so long as it relates, at least in the context of this case, to public safety. But the agency has broad authority, to be sure, in many areas, but it does not have a roving mandate to protect public safety. Congress actually specifically spoke to public safety in some other provisions of the Communications Act, for instance, the auction provisions in Title III, where it set out some spectrum for public safety and so forth. So Congress didn't think that Section 1 itself, by referencing the purpose of protecting public safety, was a freestanding, self-contained grant, not just of jurisdiction, but of authority. We just don't think it makes sense. It's a position that really makes no sense of the Communications Act as a whole, and it makes no sense of this Court's cases, which, as I've explained, when carefully read, can be broken down into situations under prong two where the Commission had to act, it said, and the Courts accepted the argument, pursuant to either Title II authority over broadcasters, Title III authority over broadcasters, or Title II authority over common carriers.
And our CCIA case, we're talking about computer services, and it said it's not exercising authority under Title II.
They declined to find that that was a common carrier
right.
service under Title II, but they asserted ancillary authority to regulate it.
Right.
And they said we have ancillary authority because this is reasonably necessary to the effective performance of our Title II duties to ensure just and reasonable rates.
Yeah.
It's somewhat circular, I admit, but the Court approved it, and there was some reference back to some substantive provision of the Act. They have utterly failed to point to anything other than Section 1, and we think that that is fatal in this case.
Thank you, Counsel. Well, you're into your rebuttal, but we'll give you back a little of it when it comes to that time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll hear from the other petitioners.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. USA Mobility agrees with CTIA and Sprint that the FCC acted without statutory authority. We wanted to argue separately to emphasize that the FCC's rulemaking process also was deeply flawed. And in particular, the FCC acted without giving proper notice of a backup power mandate. And this problem is particularly pronounced when the rule is applied to paging carriers like USA Mobility. There are three reasons in particular why notice was deficient in this case. First, as all of the parties have argued, a notice of a voluntary best practices and a desire to encourage compliance with those best practices doesn't adequately apprise parties of a potential mandate, and particularly not a mandate as sweeping as the one at issue here, where the commission required backup power at cell sites throughout the country for a specific durational period of 8 hours. That simply isn't in the notice, and it would have been very simple if the commission had been contemplating a mandate for it to ask about one. And second, even if the FCC could overcome that hurdle, it still failed to warn paging carriers of a potential mandate, because the entirety of the best practices discussion, which was voluntary, concerned only telephone companies and their provision of 911. In particular, the Katrina panel report, on which the NPRM here sought comment, briefly mentioned backup power in a section addressing, quote, the resiliency and restoration of E911 infrastructure and PSAPs. And it went on to ask how it might encourage compliance with the best practices that had been recommended by NRIC, an advisory body, for telephone companies concerning only 911 services. That discussion simply had no bearing on paging carriers because they don't participate in 911 in any way, shape, or form. Similarly, when the NPRM came out, it cross-referenced that portion of the Katrina panel report and said, again, we seek comment on ways to encourage compliance with the best practices in order to ensure a more robust 911 and E911 service. That was the only mention of backup power in the NPRM, and again, had absolutely no relevance to paging carriers because they're not participants in the 911 system. Accordingly, the only kind of logical outgrowth that could exist here, if a mandate could be defensible at all, would be one limited to providers of 911 service. But the third problem is that the NPRM not only failed to indicate that paging carriers might be subject to some kind of mandate, but everything the NPRM did say pointed exactly in the opposite direction. The thrust of the Katrina panel's discussion of paging carriers was that they provided exemplary performance during the storm, and in fact were often the only technology that allowed police, fire, and emergency medical communicators to talk to each other because cell phones and landline phones were out of service for quite some time. That discussion praising paging carriers led to a recommendation to encourage more widespread use of paging, and the NPRM took up that suggestion and recommended that indeed the FCC encourage first responders to make broad use of paging as a backup power tool. There was simply no way that USA Mobility would react to that kind of praise by commenting on a potential mandate that was nowhere in the NPRM.
The Katrina report, which you had referenced, does make reference to backup power for critical communication services.
Yes, it does, Your Honor.
Shouldn't that put somebody who uses cell sites on notice that cell sites might need to have backup power?
In this case, it did not, Your Honor, because the attributes of paging networks are fundamentally different from cell networks.
That may be a good argument against the substance of the rule, but I'm not sure how that prevents you from being on notice that you might be subjected.
Well, Your Honor, when the commission merely alludes to backup power in a single sentence and does so in the context of saying the relevance of this question is for providers of 911 service to beef up 911 infrastructure, there's
that doesn't sound like a very direct quote.
Well, Your Honor, the quote in the NPRM was that we seek comment on ways to encourage compliance with the best practices in order, quote, to ensure a more robust 911 and E911 service, unquote. So the only context that was given was 911, and this court has made clear that the context is critical in a notice inquiry. This case is just like MCI Telecommunications versus FCC, where the commission sought comment in an NPRM on requirements for enhanced services providers and ultimately extended a rule to inter-exchange carriers. The commission tried to defend its rule on the ground that you should have known that we were in the general area, and the court characterized that argument as utterly unconvincing because a rule that might be relevant to one set of providers simply doesn't give notice to a different set of providers that are differently situated. And here again, we don't think that even a mandate was noticed in the NPRM, and certainly not a mandate that led to paging carriers. Your Honor, my final point would be that the lack of notice here is critical because it led to a rule that just makes no sense.
Unless there are questions, I think your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Before you get into your substantive argument, I want to throw you a curveball. What is this case justiciable?
Is this case justiciable?
Have you submitted this rule to OMB yet?
No. After this court issued its stay, OMB informed us they would not. They would prefer not to go with forward with their process.
This rule can't go into effect unless OMB approves it.
That's correct.
All right. And we have cases in this circuit, and it goes back to Hayburn's case in the Supreme Court, that hold as follows. And I'm just pulling one out. It's National Treasury Employees Union versus FLRA. I'll just give you the site. It's 30 Fed 3rd, 1510. I'm sure this is not a curveball. You anticipated this question, right?
No, you got me.
You saw it coming. We didn't know it was going to break over the corner.
But here's what we held. Well, I don't know if it's over the plate or not, but a federal court is not presented with a justiciable case or controversy when its decision would go into effect only upon the approval of a reviewing official in the executive branch. Now, whatever we decide here will not go into effect unless OMB approves this rule. If OMB doesn't approve this rule, then what we've done is just rendered an advisory opinion. So I ask you, how in heaven's name can this case be justiciable?
Well, not to foreclose a possible jurisdictional bar here. The OMB process is to pass on the Paperwork Reduction Act information collection requirements. If they do, in this particular case, if they do not approve the rule, I believe the FCC actually has the authority to override, because it's an independent agency, to override. It's been a while since I looked at that statute, but I think they can do that.
Yeah, I looked at the statute too, and I don't know about that. The sections that we're talking about are not the sections that deal with the, you know, reduction in pay. You know, it's the information. They're not involved in this case, but. On the other hand, the FCC seemed to indicate in its reconsideration order that they're not that this is not severable. Otherwise, they would have allowed these other provisions that are at issue here to go into effect, but they withheld allowing any of the rule to go into effect pending OMB review, which indicates to me that the FCC is not treating this as severable.
Well, I agree. I think the FCC thinks the information collection aspect of this rule is an important part of this rule, not only because it implements the exemptions that the FCC created in the reconsideration order, but it provides the FCC with a lot of information about exactly how much of the communications networks in this country are protected by backup power and where the gaps are in the coverage. I do not know jurisdictionally what process a petition would be able to. Because there is a 60-day Hobbs Act limit on filing
and
petition for review.
And OMB then has to go through a rulemaking too, doesn't it?
I don't think it's a rulemaking. The information collection application that we submit to them is put out on public notice. And
for 30 days, and then they have 60 days to.
Then they have 60 days. I don't think it's a rulemaking proceeding. I'm not sure
what
the nature of the proceeding.
It sounds like it goes for public comment, and then. Yeah. Right. And you haven't even submitted it yet.
No. We were prepared to, but as I indicated, OMB informed us. With the stay in effect, they would prefer to wait until this case was resolved before they undertook their processes.
Yeah, because if we strike the rule down, then they don't have any.
Well, I'm not sure it's just that.
But on the other hand, if they strike the rule down, then we don't have to worry. Right?
Yeah.
Perhaps so. I'm not sure.
Right, I don't.
It's just the pendency of the case, but the fact that the stay was issued, I think, caused OMB to inform it. Have that preference. I think I'll just begin with the issue of statutory jurisdiction, and I think
That'd be a good place to start, yeah.
But maybe and
I think
want
the basic
supplement.
Our basic argument here.
Maybe you want a supplement.
Do you want
a
supplement
on
that issue?
I would, yeah.
Because you mentioned it in your brief. But you just mentioned.
Why don't we issue an order if
on the OMB process?
No, you mentioned
the order to issue. Giving you 10 days to address that issue. Simultaneous briefing be as satisfactory. Right, each side will have 10 days to address the issue.
Okay, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Judge Rogers.
Our basic point on the statutory authority here is we don't think we're asking the court to make any new law. This court and the Supreme Court has recognized.
I would like to ask you how your position squares with the following sentence. The Commission's general jurisdiction over interstate communication and persons engaged in such communication is restricted to that reasonably ancillary to the effective performance of its various responsibilities under Titles II and III of the Act. That's from our precedent in Southwestern Bell, quoting the Supreme Court's precedent in Southwestern Cable. How does your position square with that precedent, Counsel?
Well, I don't think it was a quote, because Southwestern Cable did not deal with Title II at all.
The quote is from, is restricted to that reasonably ancillary to the effective performance of its various responsibilities.
Yes, and Section 1 imposes.
Ratcheted in. Nonetheless, the entire sentence is the precedent of this court adopting the quotation from the Supreme Court for the substance of the sentence. So, leaving the punctuation problems aside, that is the precedent you have to square with.
Well, I can't square that language because we don't think that that is precedent. That case had nothing to do with ancillary jurisdiction, and that case was about whether the commission properly found that dark fiber was a common carrier service.
So your disposition of that case would be to say that's dicta?
That's correct. And it's dicta that contradicts.
Square with the well-reasoned dicta of Southwestern Bell Telephone.
I would counter with the implicit holding of AT&T versus Iowa Utilities Board in the Supreme Court. That case involved the Supreme Court's interpretation of Section 2B of the Communications Act, which restricts the exercise of the Commission's ancillary jurisdiction over intrastate communications. Now, what the court held there is the Commission's ancillary jurisdiction is normally broad enough to allow the Commission to regulate intrastate jurisdiction to promote an interstate purpose. And the only reason the Commission cannot do that, for example, in the context of depreciation rates, which was the issue in Louisiana PSC in 1986, is because of Section 2B. Now, if you go back to Louisiana PSC, the only source of authority the Commission invoked there for its ancillary jurisdiction to regulate intrastate rates was Section 1 of the Act. So the court's implicit holding in Iowa Utilities Board is that if Section 2B is the only prohibition preventing the Commission from exercising Section 1 ancillary jurisdiction.
Implicit holdings are always problematic. The court did not say, did it, that Section 1 is sufficient to support ancillary jurisdiction.
It was not a Section 1 case in the Iowa Utilities Board. This is a Section 1 case. We don't think the court could rule in favor of petitioners without essentially saying the Supreme Court was incorrect in Iowa Utilities Board when it held that Section 2B.
The issue was simply not considered by the Supreme Court. Yeah. They've told us that even in matters of jurisdiction, if they do not address a subject, we cannot always assume that they have made a decision upon it. They may just not have had it called to their attention.
Well, the Commission
did. That's even with Article III jurisdiction, let alone statutory.
The Supreme Court presumably understood that in Louisiana PSC, the Commission was invoking its authority under Section 1 of the Communications Act.
Well, this time we're not presuming anything. That's what you say you're invoking it under. And I'm not sure how it's consistent with Southwestern Bell, which you're trying to avoid by saying it's dicta. Anyway,
our position is that language, that one sentence in the court's opinion is dicta. That case had nothing to do with
that. Do you have a case where we or the Supreme Court have held that a preamble grants authority?
Well, MPAA holds that, Your Honor. MPAA says that under Section 1, Congress delegated authority to the FCC to expand radio and wire transmission so that they would be available to all U.S. citizens. That's the universal service aspect of Section 1.
What's the date of that opinion?
The date is...
It's a Fed third.
2002. That's after Southwestern Bell. And you also have two decisions, CCIA, which I will get to in a moment, and Rural Telephone Coalition, which upheld the Commission's exercise of ancillary jurisdiction to promote Section 1 goals.
But I just ask you about MPAA. I mean, there I thought, maybe I'm just misread it, but I thought the Commission, the court was saying that, in effect, that in Titles 1 and Titles 2 and 3, Commission has been delegated authority to accomplish the purposes in Section 1.
In MPAA,
as distinct from saying Section 1 gives the Commission a substantive authority.
MPAA did not involve Title 2 or 3 at all.
No, I understand that, but the delegated authority was simply we have delegated authority to the Commission to namely Titles II and Title III, so that it can accomplish the purposes set out in Section 1. In other words, it's distinct from saying Section 1 gives the Commission substantive authority.
Well, I, to be honest, I don't recall any language in MPAA involving Title II or III. The language was, I mean, the court repeatedly said Section 1 gives the FCC authority to regulate interstate and foreign commerce and communications. That's on page 800. Section 1 merely authorizes the agency to ensure, authorizes the agency to ensure that universal service goal.
All Section 1 does is say, here's the reason we're setting up the Federal Communications Commission. It doesn't say, every question of government is a question of ends and means. And these are our ends. Okay, this is what we want to do, Section 1. Now, here's how we're going to accomplish it, every other section after that. So I don't know how Section 1 is it. Section 1 is not an operative provision. It does not set rights. It does not prescribe duties. It is a general statement of purpose like every other preamble and every other piece of legislation that's come down the pike for 100 years.
Well, or the Constitution, for that matter.
Right. Yeah.
Well, this Court has already held that Section 1 actually prescribes duties, at least for the Commission. The Commission has a duty under Section 1.
An interpretive tool for delineating the authority of the Commission under Titles II and III. But to say that it independently grants authority does seem to be a bit of a stretch from the normal interpretive role of preambles, isn't it? I mean, we don't say that the preamble of the Constitution gives Congress the right to do everything necessary and proper to ensure the general welfare. Aren't you making that kind of an argument?
Well, no. I mean, I don't think this court, and we would submit the Supreme Court, has regarded Section 1 as merely a preamble. It's an affirmative, it sets forth affirmative obligations just as the Commission has affirmative obligations under Title II, Title III.
What do you do with the hypotheticals, though? I mean, if your position is correct, then the FCC's authority is not unbounded, but it's awfully, awfully broad. And the hypothetical, I'll just change the hypothetical, the Commission therefore would have authority to require every cell phone user to have batteries in their pocket that would back up their cell phone for 8 hours in case of emergency?
No, Your Honor, because the FCC does not have jurisdiction over every cell phone user. It does have jurisdiction.
Well, it has jurisdiction over cell phone communications.
Yes, over the devices.
All right. Well, then it's ancillary to that, because what good are cell phone communications if the battery's dead? That's the argument, right?
Well, on the question of what entities the Commission has jurisdiction over, that's not a question of ancillariness. That's a question of Section 2A. Ms. Walker read Section 2A that says the provisions of this act shall apply to all interstate and foreign communications.
And that 2A is giving you that jurisdiction over the linear.
And but it goes on to say.
That, does it?
Excuse me?
Section 1 doesn't do that, does it?
Section 2A is part of the overall set of statutes, statutory provisions.
Section 1 is the section that the Commission relied upon in promulgating this rule.
The Commission cited Section 1 because that's where the national security
and
public
safety.
We referenced the Supreme Court's case in Southwestern Cable.
What other statute did they rely on in the promulgation of this?
The Commission actually cited Section 1 and 303R, which is a rulemaking provision, and relied generally on the Commission.
Yeah, that's a rulemaking provision. That's the process. Correct. But so far as authority for the Commission to do what they purported to do here, Section 1 was their total reliance, wasn't it?
No, Your Honor. There's only one
source. What else did they cite?
They cited Southwestern Cable, which relied on.
What statute did they cite?
They did not cite under any other statute.
There's no authority that's not given it by statute, right?
That's correct.
And Southwestern Cable didn't involve Section 1.
No, but it involved the general idea that the Commission has ancillary jurisdiction, and that ancillary
jurisdiction. Ancillary jurisdiction. Ancillary implies ancillary to something. And the only thing they've given us here that it might be ancillary to is Section 1, right?
Justin, so there are two prongs of the ancillary jurisdiction test. Under the first prong, you have to ask whether the subject of the regulation is under the Commission's jurisdiction. And the Commission has jurisdiction, and that you look to Section 2A for. And the Commission has jurisdiction over interstate communications and the entities that provide.
Nonetheless, you have to be ancillary to something.
That's the second prong of the ancillary jurisdiction test. And that we can rely on Section 1
for. And here you're relying on Section 1 and
for the ancillary prong.
Alone, right?
Yes, only Section 1 for the ancillary prong
so
of the ancillary
jurisdiction. If we hold that ancillary jurisdiction to Section 1 is not sufficient to give you jurisdiction, then the commission doesn't have jurisdiction, right?
Both prongs of the test have to be met.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you, you heard counsel's comment in response to my question about the Computer and Communications Association case. What's your response? Counsel says, in that case, they were referencing reasonable rate-making authority.
Yeah. It's possible that the commission could have justified that regulation under Title II. However, the way that case came up to this court, it was justified solely by reference to Title I. This court, on page 207 and page 213 of CCIA, made clear that it's relying on the general policy goal and responsibility set forth in Title I to make available to all the people of the United States a rapid, efficient, nationwide communications service. In the underlying order, which is called the Computer II order, the commission also relied solely on Title I. And I would refer the court to paragraph 124 of that order, which begins at 77 FCC second 384, and also paragraphs 1 and 84. And the commission did not rely on section 205 or any other provision of Title II to justify its exercise of ancillary jurisdiction in that case. And that's how that case was put before the court. And
so the court says, we will defer to the commission's determination not to regulate under Section 2 because
Title 2, Your Honor.
Under Title 2 because it is regulating pursuant to its ancillary jurisdiction under 152, but it means 151.
Yeah, I mean, the ancillary jurisdiction flows from several statutory provisions. There's Section 1 generally, Section 2, which sets forth the commission's general jurisdiction over all interstate communications and all entities that provide interstate communications, and then also the rulemaking provisions of the Act.
This ancillary jurisdiction, maybe I'm missing something, but it seems to be a lot of fandango about a very simple concept. And I analogize, I was thinking, as Chief Judge Santel mentioned, the Constitution. It's like the necessary and proper clause. You know, the Constitution gives Congress certain powers, and then it has the additional power to implement those if it's necessary and proper, right? But what the Constitution doesn't say, it doesn't give Congress the power to do, is to create a more perfect union, because that's totally unbounded. That's not a limited government. That's doing, there would be no bounds to it.
The commission's ancillary jurisdiction.
Isn't it kind of like the necessary and proper clause that you have to latch onto a power that the commission has?
The ancillary jurisdiction is part of the delegated authority that Congress gave the commission. It gave the commission two sorts of regulatory authority. One is simply to implement the substantive provisions throughout the Act. And the other one is the ancillary jurisdiction, which applies when the provisions of the Act do not apply, as the Supreme Court said in AT&T. Yeah. And it's not unbounded because the commission still must have jurisdiction over the subject matter, which means it must regulate either the communications or
subject matter is not going to be sufficient. You still have to have statutory authority to do what you're doing.
Well, that's the first prong.
We have jurisdiction over certain subject matters, but that doesn't mean we can do anything we want to within the bounds of that subject.
Now, once we have jurisdiction, the regulation here does not apply to strangers in the communication industry. It applies to communications providers, which are subject expressly under Section 2A of the Act to the Commission's jurisdiction. Now, you're right, Judge Santel, that's not enough. The Commission still must find that the regulation is reasonably ancillary to responsibility that the Commission has under the Act. And this Court has repeatedly held that one of the Commission's most important responsibilities under the Act is to promote public safety through the use of wired radio communications, and that's what this regulation does.
Under your theory, could the FCC have authority to set the wage rate that the employees of these common carriers
I think the commission would have a tough time showing that's reasonably ancillary. It's not a theoretical
question. You're losing
question.
People. You don't have enough people in the critical areas, and the reason is you're not paying them enough. So,
The reasonably ancillary prong is not a theoretical prong. It looks to the commission must produce evidence connecting, say, the wage rate to the public safety, and I don't think it could. I doubt it could make that
Before
factual
you sit
showing.
Down, I'm intrigued by one thing in your brief. You don't invoke Chevron. Why?
We do mention that the Chevron framework applies generally to any exercise of delegated authority by the commission. I don't see this as much of a Chevron case. There's no dispute that backup power promotes public safety. There's no dispute.
Well, there's dispute about the meaning of the statute, though, isn't there? And no, we're dealing with a jurisdictional statute, but there's precedent in this circuit that says that the Chevron framework of deference applies even when an agency is interpreting its own jurisdiction. I don't know that I agree with that, but that's the precedent.
Although I'm cited for that proposition, I'm not sure I agree with it either.
We have conflicting citations on that point.
Well, the court.
But let me just ask you so I'm clear here.
Could you answer my question?
Sorry. Yeah. Oh. Go ahead.
Well, we do in the standard review. We do indicate generally that the commission's exercise of ancillary jurisdiction, just like any exercise of delegated authority, is subject to the Chevron framework. Generally, we didn't repeat that discussion because the issues that are joined.
What about the question whether the commission has delegated authority? Do we defer to the commission's judgment about that?
Well, we believe we have delegated authority under Section 1 to promote public safety through the use of wiring radio communications, but that's the central issue that's raised in this case.
Let me just ask one question. Judge Santel asked you about Southwestern Telephone Company. And you said that was dictum, and he said, well, what about well-reasoned dictum? I mean, there is no reasoning in that case.
I think it's just a sentence. I think it's almost a background section.
And so
sentence.
The question I have in my mind is, given that we have all of these statements in dicta, in order to hold that the commission does not have authority here because Section 1 cannot be the source of authority, under an ancillary jurisdiction claim, is it your position that we would have to overrule our decision in the Computer and Communications Industry Association case?
Yes, absolutely. You'd have to overrule that. You'd have to overrule Rural Telephone Company. You'd have to rewrite the reasoning of MPAA because that decision, even though it ruled against the commission, held that the commission had broad authority under Section 1. It simply didn't reach to the regulation of program content. And I think you would have to, going back to what I started with, you think you'd have to try to explain away the Supreme Court's reasoning in Iowa Utilities Board, albeit it's an implicit holding, but I think that there's no way to square that discussion with petitioner's argument.
Doesn't holding with you require that we do something with the Supreme Court's reasoning in Southwestern Cable and with our language in Southwestern Bell, which strikes me as being the basis for all the rest of the reasoning in that case. I mean, we finish that paragraph, then we begin the next paragraph with the centerpiece of Title II after saying why we're going to Titles II and III, because Title I is not sufficient. So don't we have to get around that language if we hold with
you? I don't think so, Your Honor. The issue in the case was whether by the fact that the carriers made certain filings to the FCC, certain dark fiber services should be treated as common carrier services under Title II. That's essentially what's known as a neighbor test. And the court held that the mere fact of filing contracts is not enough to treat something as a Title II service. And it concluded the opinion by saying we're absolutely not reaching the issue of whether the commission has ancillary jurisdiction over these services. So that nothing in that case involved the issue of ancillary jurisdiction. And
it did deal with whether Title I is an independent grant of authority.
There's that sentence, Your Honor.
Yeah, there is that sentence, which leads to the next paragraph, which deals with the Title II grant of authority, which seems to me to be that the court is leading from that proposition into the reasoning of the rest of the case.
Well, the court, I believe the holding in that case was the commission had not explained how we could regulate these services under Title II.
Or under Title II.
That's
and
correct.
We had just said we have to go to Title II because Title I doesn't grant any authority.
Oh, no, Your Honor. The court, at the end of that opinion, specifically said we're not addressing whether Title I ancillary jurisdiction reaches these services. Even though we found that Title II does not, the commission may still have authority under Title
II. Did we mention Title I in that list at the end of the opinion?
I think you mentioned ancillary jurisdiction.
We mentioned ancillary jurisdiction. No question we're dealing with ancillary jurisdiction. We are here.
Well, my only point is that language is dictum. That case in that case, the court had no occasion to address the scope of the commission's ancillary jurisdiction, as it does here.
And it didn't discuss CC IT or TI?
CCIA, no.
CCIA, thank you, yeah.
Okay, we have used up your time and then some. Do my colleagues have any further questions on this or any other point in the case? We seem to. Okay, I think we're satisfied then, counsel. Your time is up.
Thank you.
We'll give, let's see, the first petitioner had, no, 1 minute remaining. We'll bump you up to two if you want it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You understand that's a maximum, not a minimum.
Yes, sir, I'll keep it brief. Quickly, the FCC properly doesn't claim any deference under Chevron. MPAA and American Library made clear that whether you treat this under step one or step two, it doesn't matter. The issue here is whether they had delegated authority, not whether they reasonably exercised it. Second, counsel for respondents mentioned the affirmative obligation that the commission has under section 151. The affirmative obligation under section 151 is, as the court explained in Keller and Nuvio, to consider public safety when executing and enforcing some substantive power on the act. So there's no duty to rulemake under section, I'm sorry?
Would you agree, though, we have some authority that just conflicting here? I mean, I don't know what you do with CCIA.
Well, respectfully, I would direct you to page 208 of CCIA. What the court did was find general jurisdiction under 152 and 153 and then go on to reason that the exercise of ancillary authority was justified because of the direct effect of tariffing CPE on interstate transmission rates. I think that's shorthand for Title II.
But what I'm getting at, it can't be shorthand for Title II simply because the commission said it wasn't regulating under Title II and the court said essentially, fine, you're regulating under your ancillary jurisdiction.
Well,
so there's no reliance on Title II in that case.
The court accepted the proposition that you could forbear under Title II, but then still exercise some ancillary authority under Title II. But Southwestern Bell, I believe, clears this up, Judge Rogers, to the extent there's any confusion here.
Southwestern Bell isn't dealing with ancillary jurisdiction, and it is dictum, that sentence that we keep focusing on.
I do believe Judge Wald well summarized and accurately so the general statutory framework in this area.
I agree, Judge Wald well and accurately described it, but she just wrote that one sentence and didn't say anything more.
And of course, going
and it wasn't necessary for her to say anything more given the issues in that case.
Well, CCIA can be harmonized, I believe, on a thoughtful reading. Going the other way, Judge Rogers.
A thoughtful reading. I understand. I mean, I'm not. Maybe if we were deciding it today, we would decide it differently.
Right.
But, I mean, it's there on our books. And you want to reason around it by saying, well, there was Title II in the background. But Title II definitely was not what the court was focusing on.
Well, going the other way, Judge Rogers, would cause much greater disruption.
Way, but this sometimes happens with precedent.
Well, I think it could be useful for the court to clarify really what it meant. But
in
it's
bank?
Pardon me?
In bank.
Well, my client would rather not pay for that, probably. But
well, that's your decision, isn't it? That would be your decision.
Could you finish what you were going to say, that going the other way?
Going the other way is inconsistent with Supreme Court precedent, Southwestern Cable, and the ancillary authority that was permitted there, and all the cases that applied that, Midwest Video 1, Midwest Video 2, the statements that the Eighth and the Ninth Circuit have made about the power under the Commission's general purpose provisions.
The Eighth Circuit and Iowa Utilities, right?
Yes, yes. So, yes,
does
maybe.
Does that count? Does the Supreme Court reverse?
They didn't reverse on that issue, and I actually wanted to point that out. Iowa Utilities Board at the Supreme Court does not overcome what this court explained in Southwestern Bell. The Supreme Court in Iowa Utilities held that the jurisdictional division in 2B didn't prohibit the commission's exercise of its rulemaking authority under 251 and 252, the interconnection.
The issue was state preemption.
Well, the question was the jurisdictional divide between interstate and intrastate. Yes. But the commission there had rulemaking authority, and it had it. It derived it from 251 and 252 of the Act, which authorized the commission to order unbundling and interconnection. There was no question of underlying authority that the commission could rulemake on. Here the commission is claiming that Section 151 allows it to make rules to promote the public safety, and that's inconsistent, really, with the understanding of 151. It does impose an obligation, but an obligation to consider public safety when it's doing something else that it's charged actually with making rules on under the Act.
I think, unless my colleagues have further questions, you've exhausted your time. Mr. Brill, I don't think the government said anything bearing upon your issues. I don't believe you would be entitled to rebuttal. So, hearing nothing further, give us recess.